Bloomberg on the Economy with Mike McKee and Carol Masser.
Jim Bianco, he is the head of Bianco Research. And back in about mid-July, he told our Tom Keen and Ken Pruitt on Surveillance that investor returns will average about 3 to 5%. So, Jim, good morning. And I'm curious what you make of the S&P being up almost 12% so far this year.
It's a bit ahead of what I thought that the market would offer investors as we move forward. I think that what's been driving returns recently has been a belief that quantitative easing is coming from the Fed and the possibility that the ECB is going to do more. So I term this more at the higher end of what I would think you would get out of the year. Keep in mind, though, that the S&P was up 9% in January. Mm-hmm. And since January, we've pretty much not done a whole lot.
But are you a little surprised?
Yeah, I was a little surprised. Europe has still got a lot of problems. Earnings are not doing that well. Revenues at the S&P 500 companies has been nothing short of a disaster, and the market is continuing to move higher.
Well, do you think that at this point the market has priced in a Fed move, but or in September, could you add on to your returns if we get something?
No, I think it's largely pricing in a Fed move. There's probably a little bit more to go. But unless the Fed does something completely outside of the box, I think that this has been priced in. Now, what I mean by that is the consensus on Wall Street is it would be about a half trillion dollar mortgage purchase program is what the Fed would announce if there was QE3. And if we got something like that, I think that's largely priced in. Now, if we got something more aggressive than that, then maybe the market would have to reassess.
Well, we had Eric Rosengren in the Journal today, the Boston Fed president, saying they should do MBS and some more treasuries, focus on the MBS market. What would that accomplish?
I'm not sure what it would accomplish. The QE1, QE2, the two versions of Operation Twist, I'm not sure what they've done for the economy. I know that the Fed will argue the counterfactual. Well, imagine what would have happened if we hadn't done it. And the answer is we don't know. I do believe that they've had an impact on financial markets. I am with Bernanke on the idea that by doing these programs and lowering interest rates, you push people out the risk curve. But I do not believe there's been an intended wealth effect after that to justify higher valuations. So I think if they were to do this, what would it accomplish? It might accomplish higher equity prices. It might accomplish higher risk asset prices. It will just produce a larger overvaluation because I don't think it's going to lower unemployment. I don't think it's going to boost economic growth.
And Jim, you actually think that the accommodative Fed policy that we've gotten is holding back the economy. I keep going back to this. I know I've brought this up with you before, but I just find it really interesting. You actually think what the Fed's been doing is holding back what we're seeing in the economy.
Yeah, there's an old line that my friend Jim Grant has been saying about the Fed that is trust capitalism. Since the financial crisis in 2007-2008, the economy has been out of equilibrium. And the Fed's policies have been to prevent a decline in housing prices and equity prices and probably in the economy. And by doing that, they're not allowing the economy to kind of get itself reoriented and get itself restructured so that we could start moving forward. Now, reoriented, restructured, those are euphemistic words to say it's not allowing it to be bad for a while so things get fixed and then move forward. So what they're doing is they may be preventing the downside. They may be preventing the economy from being worse, the Fed. But if that is the case, they're also preventing it from being better. And so if they were to get out of the way and let the economy adjust and let the markets trust capitalism, let the markets take away money from bad ideas, give money to good ideas, and restructure it, I think then we would set ourselves up to move better, have a better economy year after year after year, other than what we've been having, which is kind of this not so good but not terrible economy year after year, which is what we've seen since 2000.
Well, for the sake of argument, let's say that happens. What would capitalism do? What would the markets do? What would change? What would be taken away? Where would money be invested?
I think that if we did that, home prices would fall a little bit more, and I think that there would be a reorientation in the home market. And then by having home prices fall and having things change a little bit there, you would maybe set up for some housing starts as we move forward. Most of the banks sell below book value. Most of the, if home prices fall, I think they would fall further below book value. It would lead to a big breaking up of a lot of what we call the too big to fail banks. I know Sandy Weill said a couple weeks ago that we should break up the banks. The simple answer is that that should be the natural conclusion from the board of directors of all these banks because they trade below book value. But if they don't want to do it, then maybe if we had further declines in home prices, they would force that, and then we would have a return of health, I think, to the financial system. Right now, we don't have securitization anymore, which was a way that consumer finances used to have credit created, and we've got a bunch of zombie banks that are running around not doing a whole lot other than getting indicted for more criminal activity every week. And until we change the banking system, I think we're just going to sit there and not do a whole lot.
Well, what hope do you have that we will change the banking system based on history?
Not much. I think that it's not going to come through regulatory changes. We've already had Dodd-Frank. We've wound up doing exactly the opposite of what we wanted to do. The top five banks have 77% of bank assets in the United States. That is the highest percentage ever.
So we're bigger than ever, aren't we?
Right. We're more concentrated.
We're more concentrated.
So we were worried about large banks too big to fail before the crisis. We made it worse. We have it bigger now than we've ever had it before. So regulatory changes aren't going to break up those big banks. They're trading below book value. The market wants those banks to be broken up. The directors and the chief executive offices of those banks don't want them to be broken up. It doesn't serve their career interests to be the head of a smaller bank. So let's let the market do it then. So since regulatory changes can't do it, since the current list of directors and CEOs won't do it, maybe more market pressure would accomplish it.
Well, in 30 seconds, because we'll have to take a break, is there any argument on the other side for having bigger banks to compete in a global economy?
Oh, I'm sure there is an argument. There's always been the supermarket argument for bigger banks, that they have one-stop shopping, that you can do a lot of good things with them and stuff. But the problem is they're really not too big to fail, as they are more too big, too complex to manage. And that's what we're finding over and over again. And it's not just the United States banks. If you go, you know, as I mentioned, you know, banks are getting indicted because of criminal activity. Most of those are foreign banks.
Yeah.
So it's almost any large financial institution is showing itself to be a too complicated entity to properly manage. And one of the downsides of that is the economy as well, too, because it relies on them for credit creation.
Jim, you got an opinion about this? The money that the Olympians get, the bonus?
Yeah, I think that any time you go down the road that you start making exceptions that certain income is taxable and other income isn't taxable, you wind up with a 25,000-page IRS code, which is what we have now. I'm in favor of making it simpler. If you make money, you get paid taxes on it. If you don't like the taxes, lower the tax rate. But not to say certain money shouldn't be taxable. And yes, I get a bonus, and I work hard for mine, and I would like mine to be non-taxable, too.
Maybe if they give it to you in gold medals. One of the interesting things in this that apparently is true, the value of the gold in a gold medal is about $675. A silver medal is worth about $385. A bronze medal is worth $5. So
yeah, I've read they're only gold plated. They're not gold throughout. They're like a lot of our coins now too. They're made of zinc, and then we copper plate the pennies, so we try to make them on the cheap.
Tim, you make that comment about simplifying the tax policy. If we did finally, ultimately, cross my fingers and everything else, did simplify the tax policy, what kind of an economic kick would we get potentially out of that if things were made much simpler?
Well, you know, leaving aside the revenue side of it, you're right. There's been a number of think tanks that have, the Cato Institute in particular, that have looked at it and said that compliance with tax regulation costs at least as much as the taxes we pay. So when we look at the idea that, you know, we're paying $2 trillion of taxes, the decisions that we make and what we try to do to avoid taxes could also be another $2 trillion. So I'm not even talking about let's lower the rate. If we just made it simpler and we were making more sound decisions and we didn't need, whole floors of attorneys like they have, or tax accountants like they have at GE, I think that it would lower a lot of the costs all the way down the line. So, yeah, it would be a big deal if we were to make it a lot simpler for everybody.
Now, you follow all of the markets on a daily basis. And we were talking earlier in the program about technology and its impacts on the markets. And referring back to a quote from John Phelan, who was the chief of the New York Stock Exchange in the 1987 crash, that said, if we let technology go too far, if we let volatility rise too much and it become just a market for trading professionals, that we're in big trouble. Have we gotten there?
If we're not there now, we're really close to it. If you look at the volume numbers on the New York Stock Exchange or even on U.S. traded stocks, they're down a lot. They're down a lot this year as well, too. While there's no official statistic, the percentages that of trading that goes on via computer is expected to be somewhere around 75%, meaning that it's really hard to see where human beings are trading this stuff anymore. And you can see it in the way the market trades. If there's ever a big announcement, say the payroll report on Friday or something else, the market moves instantaneously. Human beings can't get the data that fast, digest it, and then make a decision. It's all computers reading the stories and reacting before we can even comprehend what's happened. And you're right. As a result of that, what we've seen in the market now is a typical quiet summer day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 75 points right now. It was up 200 on Friday, and that's not even news anymore. So even though the VIX might be down, which is what people expect on volatility, the actual volatility is actually very high. A 1% day or is becoming common. We get a couple of them a week, and I do think it is largely because of technology.
Safe to say, technology has made a lot of things better. I love my cell phone. I love running water and all that good stuff, Jim. But in terms of the increased technology and the programs that we've seen on Wall Street, not good? I mean, would you rather see some of that stuff go away?
Yes, I would. You're right. Technology makes this better, but then the other problem is technology for technology's sake. A lot of this high-frequency trading and a lot of this rapid-fire trading, I'm struggling as to what is the economic purpose of it, but yet we have co-location agreements with big servers that everybody puts their server next to so that they could move ever faster and ever faster for all this trading. Now, they'll tell me that it's helped to create liquidity, but I think the opposite is happening. It creates so much volatility, it drives people out of the market, and it just leaves computers banging against computers. So, yeah, the technology is great, and I'm all for technology, and I'm as, big a technology buff as there is. But I also recognize that anything taken to an excess can wind up being bad, and I do think that a lot of this high-speed trading has been taken to an excess. I don't understand the economic value of it, and I do think it might be hurting us around the edges.
Yeah, you have a lot of people saying that night trading, had there still been a lot of specialists on the floor handling those orders, you would have had a human being who would have said, this makes no sense, stop. And the computers didn't stop. But what could be done? I mean, is there any way, if you were to convene a meeting of market participants and regulators. Do you have any thoughts on how you could bring the markets back to sort of their goal of companies raising money to invest?
Yeah, I think there's one simple rule you could do, and that would be to move the bid-ask offer on stocks to 5 cents so that the smallest increment they could move would be 5 cents. Right now, stocks can trade on the fourth decimal, 1/100th of a penny. And that's what encourages a lot of this trading that goes on because they're trying to capture less than a penny. But if you moved it to 5 cents, you're not going to get this rapid-fire in-and-out trading like you didn't have before when we used to trade stocks on a 16th when we were still using fractions. That's 6 1/4 cents. Now that I've said that, it won't happen because the exchanges, they make a lot of money off this rapid-fire trading. They have no desire to see it go away right now. I've likened it to hockey. Hockey, the biggest problem I've said with hockey is that it's fighting. I like to watch hockey. I don't like to watch fights. But yet they're afraid to get rid of the fighting because they're afraid they're going to get rid of their fans. Well, this is what's happened with the exchanges. We don't necessarily like rapid-fire trading. We'd like more fundamentally based trading, but they're afraid to get rid of it because they would lose a lot of their revenue in the short term.
I mean, and could we even go back, Jim, at this point? I mean, I remember fractions too. I hate to date myself, but I mean, I remember that. But could we even go back at this point?
Diffractions, no. I don't think we can go back to those. It was only the mid-90s, so it wasn't that long ago that we got rid of fractions.
Thank you.
It's a polite way of telling you you're not that old.
Yeah, exactly.
Just feels that way.
But we don't necessarily have to go to fractions, but we could go to wider bid offer spreads where, you know, your stock would either trade at $28.05 or $28.10. We could do that. That wouldn't be as big of a move backwards as it would be to go all the way back to fractions.
One of the arguments would be, well, you know, you're costing customers money if they have to, you know, if they have to pay more.
They would have to pay more, because there would be a 5-cent bid offer. But those that would be severely paying more are the rapid-fire traders that would be paying more, the high-frequency traders, as we refer to them. They would be paying more, but that would be the design of it, would be to slow a lot of that down. Because right now, you know, we've had the flash crash with the rapid-fire trading that we've had. And while no one wants to say it out loud, the SEC report on the flash crash largely concluded they don't know why it happened. And they really don't have any real good fix for why it can't happen again. And then we have night trading. And so these problems continue, and they continue to make people believe that the market is more of a casino than it is a place to, you know, allocate capital. And I think it does damage in the long run.
There's some good ideas from Jim Bianco. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Listen to Bloomberg on the Economy weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg 1130 in New York or on Sirius and XM Satellite Radio Channel 113. Copyright 2012.